Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. The Covenants of the Gods, Chapter 1, Holy Matrimony versus Marriage.
Now, in our previous examination of holy matrimony and marriage, we see that holy matrimony was an institution of God from the beginning. It was a part of creation, a part of His original design. It was His institution, His creation. We see Jesus Christ also repeating some of the same basic concepts we see way back at the beginning in Genesis, that it's two people joined together, a man and a woman, and that they are joined together under the authority of God as if they were one person, and that joining should never be interfered with or put asunder by anyone except for God. We see it as a foundation of society. It is the precept upon which all government is established, is the same precepts we see flowing through holy matrimony. We also see that it is a covenant between two people, and in order to make it holy, it also is before God. That principle is critical to understanding what holy matrimony is and how it ought to be free. It needs to be free, otherwise there is someone meddling into that relationship which is only before God. And even the Bible bears this out, that the son and daughters who marry are to leave their father and mother and forsake them. It doesn't mean abandon them. It means that they become a unit unto themselves. They still had ties in ancient times to their parents. They still honored their parents. If something happened to the husband or to the wife or to both parents, it was the parents of the son, usually, who took the children in and continued to guarantee that they would be raised and taken care of. This was a part of that social security. This is what a patriarchal society is all about. We see that the political societies that men create for themselves with these contracts has often taken the position or taken the place of the father in the ancient patriarchal societies such as Israel. We see that the word marriage has several definitions, some of them quite distinctively different. We see that marriage is a relationship between simply a free man and a free woman who have contracted together because they were able to contract, because they desired to contract into this thing we call matrimony. And that contract was called marriage. But we also see another kind of contract that is talked about by the civil state, where the contract is a civil status, where it is a civil contract, where it is solemnized by activities and participation with the civil state, and that it carries with it certain duties legally incumbent upon the two along with the community, and that it is a three-party contract between a man and a woman and the state. Now, before that, all our definitions clearly did not designate that there was this third-party contract. But in this civil contract, which is called marriage, the same as that previous contract, which was not civil, which was private, as it was designated in the law, there is this vast distinction between what the duties and what the authority is in that relationship. That relationship of marriage under the civil state or under a civil status is a very controlling power over that husband and wife relationship. They can't dissolve it on their own. The dissolution of property is often determined by that civil power. The dissolution or placement of the children is often decided by that civil power. And it is clearly that when one enters into such a contractual agreement that they become unequally yoked with the powers that make statute. And also that this relationship is not required by law, but is actually a departure from the law, because you are entering into a relationship where there is an equitable control over this relationship. It's now a public relationship. It's under the magistrate. It will be decided by statute and not by law. Now, some people would find that surprising. Is statute law? Well, yes, it's created by law, but the law is basically the law of contract. I mean, there are basic laws such as not being murdered and not being robbed. These are obvious basic laws, but you have rights, inalienable rights, that are granted to you by God. And if someone were to come and take away those rights, that would be a violation of law. But if you were to contract with somebody so that you no longer had access to those rights as you fulfilled the terms of the contract, then that would be a new law that you were a part of that creation of. And this, of course, is why we are told not to make these covenants wherever we go. Now, we've talked a little bit about holy matrimony. We've mentioned it. But there is a thing called the rite of holy matrimony, and that's R-I-T-E, rite, as opposed to R-I-G-H-T. But the rite of holy matrimony is really very simple. A rite is, it's a Latin word that means duly and formally, legally, properly, and technically. So when we talk about the rite of holy matrimony, we are just talking about what's proper in holy matrimony, the technicalities of holy matrimony, what is its formal necessary aspects in order to create that relationship. Well, they're really very basically simple. We've talked about several of them. Obviously, if holy matrimony would be matrimony under the authority of God, not under the authority of someone else, what would be proper is, of course, that it was a man and woman, because this is a matter of the law of nature and the divine will of God. And clearly, he created man and woman, and he joined them together, and for the purposes of being fruitful and multiplying. And any other relationship, such as man and man or woman and woman, does not follow that criteria and therefore would not be proper. This is obvious, basic common sense. Now, there's a lot of debate that the state is talking about legalizing homosexual marriages. And of course, the state can go and do that. Christians really shouldn't be having those state marriages, because those are three-party civil contracts with the state, giving the state power over a holy relationship that is to be free before God. There is no reason for a Christian to do that. They are giving up inalienable rights granted to them by God when they do so. They are actually becoming unequally yoked, which they are not supposed to do so. So we see very clearly that that holy matrimony is not what we see taking place in the civil contracts with the state. There are a few other things that might be a part of that rite of holy matrimony. If you go to a church and get an ecclesiastical matrimony, which has no legal significance with that body that was producing this civil contract, and therefore it is not civil in nature, but free in nature, because there is religious freedom in this country, are you getting married under the authority of the church? Well, no, you're not. That's not what the church's function is. The church is not allowed to exercise authority. This is a command of Christ. You are not to be like the governments of the Gentiles who exercise authority one over the other. So clearly we are not to be that way, even though we know that a legal marriage is going under the authority of the state with that matrimonial relationship. Now, just as an examination, so that you can see another witness, I'm going to quote from a canon law. Now, canon law, that's a little frightening term for a lot of people, because they associate it with some bad things in history. Canon law is not like a legal statute law. It's more like words and phrases. Canon law has no authority. Hopefully, those things that have been written down by men to be canon law are supposed to be those men's opinion of what is divine will. That's what canon law is supposed to be. It may be in many cases. Each one of these cases we should look at individually and pray to God and find out and discuss these things and study these things out and see, are they in accordance with the Word of God? Well, one canon law is a CCC 1623 to do with marriage, so I'll read that here. In the Latin Church, it is ordinarily understood that the spouses, as ministers of God's grace, mutually confer upon each other the sacrament of matrimony by expressing their consent before the church. Now, clearly, I have no problem with that. All they're saying is that the church is a witness to their consensual agreement. That's a very free interpretation of this relationship of sacramental or holy matrimony. And I would have to agree with what that particular canon law states, because it is, you're not married under the authority of the church. You are married under the authority of God, who is called as a witness to the contract that you make. He is the one who joins you together, not the church. The church is just facilitating the public announcement of this union, this contract, this covenant, this relationship that is before God. Remember that an ecclesiastical relationship is distinguished from that of civil and secular. It is a separate one, but you are just as married. Remember also that the word church is from the Greek ekklesia, which is two words meaning the called out. Now, there are many words that mean assembly in the Greek. Some of them show up in the New Testament, but they specifically use this word ekklesia in reference to what we now translate as church, and it means the called out. Well, like the Levites were called out, and so was the first century church called out to minister to the people of the kingdom of God, which was at hand. Is your church calling you out or calling you into a relationship with a foreign power, a civil authority, which you are not required to do, but when you do, you waive certain God-given rights? This is the question that we're bringing up. We know that matrimony ought to be free. We know that civil is a word used in contradistinction to military, ecclesiastical, natural, or foreign. And we know that marriage is a natural relationship. Husband and wife is a natural relationship. We know that all an ecclesiastical relationship is that the church as a body bears witness to your natural relationship of husband and wife before God, which is the way it was from the beginning. We know that marriage is a contract by which a free man and a free woman come together in this union of husband and wife, one of the greatest domestic relationships, that relationship being that of a man and a woman lawfully joined in marriage, by which, at common law, the legal existence of the wife is incorporated with that of her husband. These are traditions that come down to us through the ages. We also know that in the time of Plato, he had a number of different ideas that were contrary to what we have been talking about. For instance, his economic plan was that no gold or silver was to be owned by any citizen. It was to be kept in a treasury away from them because, as Hitler says, gold in the hands of the people is the enemy of the state. It gives them a certain sovereignty and freedom from government. Egypt and Israel, the Israelites, with their golden calf, they were trying to do the same thing, and Moses clearly disapproved of that. Socrates had a concept of the equality of between the sexes, that women would be in the military, wives and children held in common, and women will be permitted to have sex with almost anybody. But yet the husbands of those women were responsible for the raising of those children. These are all concepts that came out of Greece with Plato and Socrates. He had the idea that men would have no private women, no private children or servants, and also that the land and property that he held and worked was actually owned by the state and could be taken away from him if he did not produce enough income for the state to operate on. Now, these are all concepts completely contrary to what we see Moses doing, where the people had possession of the land. They could not be taxed on the land. They could not be taken off of the land, that the husband and wife were a sacred unit, that the children belonged to the parents and the parents were supposed to train them up, and that they were to carry their gold and silver and be responsible for it in their own purse. Completely diametrically opposed to this idea that we see coming out of Greece. In 2 Kings 17:15, we see, "And they rejected his statutes and his covenants that he made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed vanity and became vain, and went after the heathen that were round about them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them." And of course, we see Jesus Christ saying the same thing, that we were not to be like the kingdoms of the Gentiles, who had their benefactors, who exercised authority. And of course, that's not the way America was originally, but it has become that way, where the government has control over every aspect of our lives. And the reason why is because we have done what God told us not to do, and that was to make covenants with them. we have become like the heathen round about us, who believe in concepts such as no differencing between the sex. Now, there is an equality. We're both created in the image of God, but the idea that there is no difference is simply ridiculous from the point of view of biblical understanding of creation. The idea of taking all our gold and silver and putting it in the treasuries of the government and we simply having some sort of script in our pockets is also clearly contrary to what God had in store for the people back in the time of the Israel and in Egypt, where we were told to have no diverse weights, etc. All these things are practices of the heathens. They are not part of the rites of God's kingdom. In other words, when I say rites there, that's that R-I-T-E rite, because it's not proper. We are God is the same yesterday as he is today, and we should not be changing these things. And we are changing these things by our activities, by our contracts, by our applications. Now, Romans 13 tells us, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Well, how are they ordained of God? They are ordained of God because God expects us to keep our contracts. Of course, he tells us hundreds of times not to make these contracts, but if we do, he will hold us to them. And they get their power from our application and contract. In 2 Corinthians, we see, and what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with infidels? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. But are we doing that? In 2 Corinthians, it also says, just before that, be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion hath light with darkness? We are having a fellowship with systems that are doing contrary than what God has taught us from the very beginning. We are becoming unequally yoked by our contracts, by our applications, with people who do not believe in the Bible, do not believe in the precepts that God has given us through the ages of prophets that have gone before and through Christ's own words. Wherefore, come out from amongst them, and be ye separate, we're told, and touch not the unclean things, and I will receive you, and I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be a son and daughter, saith the Lord Almighty. Now that has long-range influence through the activities that we are participating in. Are we really sons and daughters of the Father in heaven, or have we become sons and daughters of our Father, the state on earth? I mean, we ask them for permission to marry, which used to be the exclusive right of our parents. We ask them to train our children. And in other meetings, we go into detail how this we are really turning the state into our fathers here on earth. We have gone under the authority of a state that is contrary to what God has ever created, that is more like Egypt, which God chose to take us out of, told us never to go back to. And how do we go under that? Well, of course, as I said over and over again, through contract. Exodus 23:32, thou shalt make no covenants with them nor with their gods. Now, are we making covenants with gods? Well, actually, we are. It says, they shall not dwell in thy lands, lest they make thee sin against me. And if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. Now, people want to say those gods are just little statues, and we go over this over and over again, that clearly throughout history, that's not what it was. That's not what the words mean. If you look in the Greek text, the word God, theos, it was used every day to address magistrates in courts of law because they had an exercising authority. Even in Strong's Concordance, it will tell you that these gods are ruling judges. Even the Bible tells us that. If you take King James Bible, several places where the word Elohim in the Bible shows up, they translate it judge because it says they brought them before the judges. But that's the exact same word that's translated everywhere else into the word God. And even again in the Strong's Concordance will bear you out that that was a term used to address magistrates, public magistrates. So see, by that contract, that covenant, you are making covenants with gods. You are going under exercising authorities that have a right to rule over what should have been a holy matrimony and is now a civil contract, a civil status whereby you have gone under the authority of another, something Paul said he would not do. He would not go under the authority of others. Now, I know a lot of these concepts are new to you. If you get a lot of our other material, we'll show you over and over again in books like The Covenants of the Gods and series of tapes that go along with that, exactly how this works. And it's repeated over and over and again in the Bible. This is not just made up by somebody. It's clearly laid out in the Bible. We show you there's over 600 footnotes in The Covenants of the Gods and other books that we have available that show you where we're getting this from. We wouldn't want you to take our word for it. We don't want you to believe in us. We want you to look at the Bible. We want you to pray about it. We want you to believe in the precepts of God and the precepts that have come down to us through the Bible. As Daniel Webster says, that we need to know those and live by those because it will make a difference, not only for our everlasting soul, but for the lives of our family and our children here on the face of the earth that God has given us. We are told, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of the sacrifice. Now the fact is, if these gods are judges, men who have exercising authority, that's why in Rome, Caesar was called a god. And we think, oh, how blasphemous. All it meant was that he was the apotheos of Rome. He appointed all the judges. That's what that office did. Of course, the President of the United States has the same office. He appoints all the federal judges throughout the entire empire of the United States. No, we don't want to call empire the United States, but the fact is all the states are separate countries bound together by contracts and agreements with this single authority, which has become stronger and stronger because it too has contracted with the federal government. And that federal government literally stands in the position of appointing gods throughout the empire. The federal judges are very active. They have a great deal of power. It wasn't that way at the beginning, but it has come that way over the years. Even the President of the United States is referred to as the apotheos, just like it was in the time of Rome, as well as the word imperator, meaning commander-in-chief. These are all commonly understood precepts. Capitol Dome, the picture in the head of the Capitol Dome. If you look up there, there's a big, huge picture with George Washington in the center and all the Greek gods around there, and it's called the apotheos of Washington. That's the name of the painting. And on the U.S. government website, it tells us that it raises Washington to the rank of God. That's actually what it says, quote unquote. Because he is the ruling judge in the sense that he could pick all the other ruling judges. We have a Supreme Court here. They had a Supreme Court in Rome as well. The United States and Rome are identical forms of government. The emperors were actually elected by an electoral college. It often became totalitarian, and there is no reason to believe that the United States might not do that as well. But that is their problem. We're Christians. We're to be seeking the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness. And if we do that, everything else will work out. So how does this relationship, this contractual relationship, this unequal relationship with the state affect us in our relationship with our families and our children? Well, we know in Genesis 35:11 that it says, "And God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee. The king shall come out of thy loins." Well, what kings? Well, all the people in Israel were called kings. The head of every household was a king. It says for 400 years there was no king in Israel, and every man did as he wanted because his tent was his castle, his home was his castle. And we talk about that in great detail, how that worked, how they still had an orderly government without a top-down authority, and how all that changed when they turned their back on God and decided to have a top-down authority government that was chosen by the voice of the people. It was a representative form of government, but still there was authority placed in the hands of these people in the higher echelons. That's not the way Israel was at first. The Levites had no authority. They couldn't compel tithings. Things like that didn't take place till about 160 BC and 78 BC when they passed statutes to force the collecting of the temple tax. That when tithings and free will contributions became tax, contrary to the wish of God. Genesis 33:5 says, "And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children, and said, Who are those with thee? And he said, The children which God hath graciously given thy servant." In other words, God gives us our children. We are one flesh, and our children are the product of that. Those children belong to us. Now, the state may have a different opinion of that, but we know that that's what God wants, and that's what we should be working for, and we should do nothing to endanger that right to our children. We should do nothing that betrays that trust that God has placed in us by entrusting us with those precious lives that are the children and the fruit of our wives' wombs and the fruit of our loins. Custom and the common law also agree with natural law. For at the common law, the father had an almost absolute right to the custody of his children. And of course, the father and wife are one flesh. But there was no custody of the children by virtue of the state. The state didn't own the children. Now, Socrates had that idea. Socrates advised in Plato's Republic, take all the children from their parents and rid the city of adults. These are these wise men that they have been teaching our children about in the universities and in the colleges. That was their idea of what is proper and right. He also says the young can't distinguish what is allegorical from what isn't, and the opinions they absorb at that age are hard to erase and apt to become unalterable. But of course, we see similar things said in the Bible. But of course, they're teaching different principles. They're teaching the sanctity of the home and the importance of marriage. Now, we look around at the rate of divorce and the breaking up of homes. Something is going on here that is an abomination. Let's turn and look at some other opinions of modern government and see, are they in connection with the Bible? Are they in agreement? Or are they in agreement with these heathens such as Socrates and Plato, who are smart men and clever men, but not wise according to the ways of God? In 1983 in Nebraska, there was a conflict between a small Baptist church and the state of Nebraska. The conflict was over the fact that the Baptist church wanted to have its children taught in its own little private school, and the state wanted them to be highly regulated in this activity. They thought that the state was usurping rights that were given to them by God, and they would have been correct except for the fact that they had actually waived those rights already. There was a kind of a touching scene, as it was described to me, between the judge and that pastor in jail, where the judge informed the pastor in a roundabout sort of way so that he could understand what was really going on, and he was completely missing it. Is the fact that the church had already incorporated under the state. By becoming an incorporation of the state, you waive your rights as the body of Christ, and you are now become a part of the body of the state. And you are now highly regulated by the state, and controlled by the state, and by the state statutes, and by the judges of the state, because they are now the ones who have exercising authority over you, because you have sought after the heathens and their gods, their judges. And so now they have authority. Now, you can call them wicked if you want. Jesus already told you to make anything more than yes for yes and no for no. Any other agreement, swearing, binding agreement, contract, cometh of evil. He's already told you that. You knew that. You just didn't apply it in your life. So you went out and incorporated your church. Now, we go into great detail and explain all about that in Body of Christ versus Body of the State. And that's, we have a pamphlet form. We have it in other forms. It's also the last chapter of the Covenants of the Gods. But the point is that it is these previously existing contracts that got them into trouble. The state was not usurping authority. It had already been given away. And it had been given away because they had applied to the state so that they get benefits of the state. And that pastor learned that he wasn't going to do that anymore. But an interesting quote came out of this whole thing from a Peter Hoagland, who was a Nebraska state senator at the time. In an interview with the pastor, he made a statement that was, fundamental Bible-believing people do not have the right to indoctrinate their children in their religious beliefs because we, the state, are preparing them for the year 2000, when America will be a part of a one-world global society and their children will not fit in. Now, that idea and many ideas that are similar to that are pervasive throughout government and the world today. It's interesting that they refer to the right to indoctrinate their children in their religious beliefs, but when the state teaches the children their beliefs, it's not indoctrination, it's just education. Actually, we do have a right and an obligation given to us by God to educate our children. And it's stated over and over again, and it's just common sense to realize that. And to educate our children does not mean to have somebody else educate the children. You don't actually hire the teachers. You don't control the curriculum. Even if you got terribly involved in your local public school, you would realize that it is a bureaucracy out of your control, and you have very little say-so. You can kind of fight at windmills or bucket the ocean out into a little hole, but you're not really going to have much effect on it. Even if you gather together in a fairly large group, there's a certain amount of authority you're just not going to obtain. The children should be educated at home. And in congregations of people, they can facilitate that and do an excellent job. Homeschoolers right now score 30% higher on all tests. And as well as social skills, they're much higher rated in social skills, better adjusted even in colleges and universities. And you can actually go all the way through college in the homeschooling courses now and save a tremendous amount of money. You will probably have to go away, depending on what studies you're taking, to do lab works and things like that. But a great deal of it can be done at home at a tremendous cost saving and very successful. Because if you've already learned how to study and learn, those homeschooling courses can make you quite capable, more so than those who's, you know, people tell me that the university is a fountain of knowledge, yes, and all the students go there to drink, but not so much the knowledge. There's a great deal of influence in the colleges that is not exactly to the benefit of your children. Anyway, there's these ideas. Where do they come from? Well, clearly that, like William Sewell said, each child belongs to the state. It does if you've contracted away your right to your children. Some of these ideas come from men like Socrates and Plato that I was always told are really brilliant, smart, and intelligent men. But the more I got into what they were writing and telling and began to grow up, I realized that they were very intelligent men, but they were not very wise men. And they certainly were not teaching precepts in accordance with Jesus Christ or the Bible. And they're actually preaching a form of governance that is absolutely contrary to the principles that were handed down to us in the Bible. And most people don't even know what those principles were because they've been highly distorted and not really attended to in the way that they should be, in my humble opinion. But we have a great deal of information on this, and you can access it on the web or wherever and find out if we're telling the truth. Socrates advised in Plato's Republic, which is not really a republic. Plato's Republic is kind of like Wayne's World. It's Wayne's World of the Republics, because it was really contrary to everything that it was a republic, but they called it Plato's Republic. I didn't realize that until much later when I went into much deeper studies of what these things are. And we cover that in Republic versus Democracy and Democracy versus Republic. Take all the children from their parents and rid the city of adults. That was Socrates' idea. He thought that was a great idea. Well, that's that. The communists did that when they took over Phnom Penh. They got rid of all the adults and the children took over. The young can't distinguish what is allegorical from what isn't, and the opinions they absorb at that age are hard to erase and apt to become unalterable. Well, that's very understandable. We see in Proverbs, train up your children in the ways he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. They're just using the ideas out of Proverbs. The problem is what are they teaching them when they've removed the adults? Are they teaching him wisdom? Are they teaching him God's principles? Are they teaching him heathen principles? Carol Warner said those who educate are more to be honored than those who bear the children. The latter give them only life. The former teach them the art of living. Well, that's very true. And I can't disagree with that. My question is what do they call the art of living? Is the art of living according to those precepts that are in the Bible, or are they according to promiscuity, irresponsibility that I see? Are they learning how to use drugs and other paraphernalia that are destroying their lives? Are they developing values that will be breaking down the family? Well, all of the above, those things are around, they're rampant. And we're putting our children out on the front lines of this corruption and expecting them to come out of the schools uncorrupted. If the teachers and the books don't twist and distort their minds, their peers will. Some children survive in spite, but homeschoolers are scoring much higher, both in social skills as well as academics. And not only that, the parents are rewarded in the process of homeschooling in ways they cannot even imagine. And we are told in the Bible over and over again, "And ye shall teach them your children, speak of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." That's homeschooling. That's what it's all about. The kids are there all the time. "Gather me the people together, and they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children." These principles are repeated over and over again in the Bible, and I see nowhere where Christ changed that. "Suffer unto me the little children," not send them away to somebody else who won't even let a Bible in their school. People said, "Oh, it's terrible that they're taking the Bible out of school." To me, it's terrible that you're not taking your children out of school. You should be homeschooling. That's my opinion, and you can take it for what it's worth. Now, I should talk to you a little bit about the word person. We mentioned it before that it's a very important concept to understand. In one of the definitions in Black's Third, it says marriage is also defined as that which signifies the act, ceremony, or formal proceeding by which persons take each other for husband and wife. Well, persons are members as opposed to individuals. They're not the same thing. Persons are members of something, and their status depends on the nature of that membership and what they're a member of. In American law and procedure states the word person and its scope and bearing in the law, involving as it does legal fictions on one hand and apparently natural beings, it is difficult to understand, but is absolutely necessary to grasp at whatever cost a true and proper understanding of the word in all its phases and proper use. Well, we're not going to do that here, but we do touch on the word person over and over again in the Covenants of the God series and in other places where we're even not delving so deep into subjects of law and the Bible and history. But that concept of person, some people talk about straw men these days. That's a real popular term. Basically, a person is a member, and a person is measured according to his status. The mere definition goes on to say the law of persons is the law of status or condition. So if you're a person, your status or condition is what is determined in that identification as person. A moment of reflection enables one to see that a man and a person cannot be synonymous, for there cannot be an artificial man, though there are artificial persons. Thus, the conclusion is easily reached that the law itself often creates an entity or a being which is called a person. The law cannot create an artificial man, but it can and frequently does invest him with artificial attributes. This is his personality. That is to say, a man person, the abstract person, which are fictions and which have no existence except in law, and that is to say, those which are purely legal conceptions and creations. Now, this word fiction keeps showing up now and then. A lot of people think, well, that's a fiction. That doesn't have anything to do with anything. When Christ says they are no more twain but one flesh, referring to a husband and a wife, they aren't one flesh. That's a fiction. But in the point of view of Christ and the point of view of God, they are one flesh. He treats them as if they're one flesh, even though they're physically not one flesh. They're not Siamese twins. They're not sewed together. It's a purely legal conception or creation. But, of course, when God says it, it carries a great deal more weight with me than, say, some bureaucrat says it. But the fact is that, what the governments of the world do is take the principles of God and they turn them to their own purpose. This is what Cain did with the first city-state. This is what Nimrod did. Pharaoh, Caesar. This is what these centralized governments who take the position of father are doing. They're taking the precepts laid down by God and they're creating in their own image another system. You still have someone who teaches the children the art of living, but their art of living is based on different concepts other than that of God, as it was from the beginning. And the whole point of studying the Bible and trying to find out what God's will is so that we can turn around and follow that will in our lives in a practical way, not just a few hours on Sunday where we sing about it, and not with just kind of pie-in-the-sky concepts of God's way, but God's way that affects every aspect of our lives. I mean, Christ is telling us many things to do and not do. He says, swear not at all. How many Christians swear on a regular basis? Swearing is not cussing. It's taking oaths. It's making agreement. And the idea that Jesus is saying not to do that because it cometh of evil is not a new idea. James says, above all else, stop the taking of oaths. Why? Because over and over again in the Old Testament, God was telling us not to make covenants, not to make contracts with the people or the inhabitants or with their gods. These are agreements. What agreement have we with Belial? We're not supposed to be making these agreements. And if you make those agreements, you change the nature of your personality. You change the nature of your person. Now, you may be a person already because you have a membership, but turning around will start taking you back in the other direction. When Moses came to Egypt, he didn't say, okay, everybody rescind your documents, get rid of your pharaonic ID, and stop paying taxes, and let's go do our own thing. No, he went through a whole process, and there was hard times, difficult times, and the people learned to work together and fill their water flasks and glean in the fields at night, and they did a little overtime, and they congregated together so that in one day, in one moment, they woke up, or actually maybe they never went to sleep that night. I'm sure some of them dozed off. But anyway, they got up the next morning and they walked out. They had a whole system that was ready to go, and they were interconnected and able to go out into the wilderness. Now, of course, the early Christians on Pentecost, they didn't have that. They didn't go necessarily to a wilderness, although many of them did wander away from Israel before its destruction. Many of them were there right up to the last day of its destruction of Jerusalem. The point is, they started creating that network. That network was already under construction when Jesus Christ was preaching the kingdom of heaven and had supporters everywhere and was sending out his apostles to preach the kingdom of heaven. And there was actually groups of men who were doing something very similar to John the Baptist. And before John the Baptist, were already preaching the kingdom of heaven. Even Herod was preaching the kingdom of heaven, but his idea of the kingdom of heaven was an art of living that was more in line with the Hellenists, with the Socrates and the Plato crowd, with the idea of separating and breaking down the family and getting all the gold and silver in his treasury and where it might be stolen. And of course, the kingdom of heaven doesn't operate that way. The money stays in your pocket, the way Moses said, the way Jesus says. And you must decide daily how to grant that money and share that money with the other members of your congregation in times of need. And you create a network in which to do this. And family is at that core. Every person is a man, but not every man a person. A man is a term of nature, a person of the civil law. Wife and son are names of nature. The civil law is what people establish for itself. God's law is much different. Unless those people are very godly people. But what we see being established today and for many, many years as the civil law is contrary to what we see established in the Bible. And the reason it has power and authority is because you're contracting and applying to it and giving it that power and authority. Governments don't have power unless you give it to them. You must go under their authority and give them that power. You need to learn how to live in the world, but not of the world. A person who is in present possession of an office, one who is legally authorized to discharge the duties of an office. If you get a marriage license, husband and wife are no longer the natural terms that we see mentioned in those maxims that I just read to you. It is an office. It is an office delegated to you by the authority of the state. You are now a person. Your personality is tied in with the state. Your soul, literally your soul, is tied in with the state. A soul is, from a legal standpoint, is your corporeal or incorporeal hereditaments of personality. And that's what it consists of. When Abraham left the city-state of Ur, he took many souls with him. In other words, they gained possession of themselves and they went out and did something completely different. There's a sample bill that was created in order to comply with U.S. Code Title 42, Section 666. Just happens to be that number, folks. I didn't say anything about the Mark of the Beast, but this is actually its number, Section 666. We wrote about this years ago in the Ecclesia News when it was first, before it even became laws, any of this. But we knew all about it. We're telling people. There was Bill 532 is back in 1997. And give you a lot more details on it. But basically, the document requiring a Social Security number for use in child support enforcement. And they do this for other purposes. But it says no marriage license may be issued unless a written application shall have been filed with the probate judge. Goes on, Darlington County and Georgetown. This is a, remember, this is a sample bill. Counties, the clerk or the court who issues the license at least 24 hours before its issuance. The application must be signed by both of the contracting parties and shall contain the same information as required by the issuing of the license, including the Social Security number of the contracting parties. That's very important. It's exactly the way it was in the time of Rome when the early Christians were fighting the same basic system that was rising up. What some of you might not have understood, that U.S. codes are divided up into a lot of different numbers, titles, they call them, and this is Title 42, and the Section 666. They needed bills in each individual states to comply with this mandate that Social Security numbers will be tied to every aspect of your life. Businesses, even you can't even get a death certificate without a Social Security number. And of course, we have a lot of information on what the Social Security number is. I'm not telling you to go get rid of it. I just want to tell you what it is. You and God have to work out whether you should have one or not. And as Paul says, if you can be free, choose it rather. But if you can't be free, you're going to have to labor under that system until you can get free. And if you owe the taxes, pay the taxes. It's because you have to learn to be friends with the unrighteous mammon, for when it fails, and it will fail, that you will be more suitable for God's kingdom. And the righteous habitations, a more permanent habitation. And that concept is that basically simply give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Nothing is contradictory in the Bible. If you think it's contradicting itself, you probably don't understand what's going on. There is also, I just thought I'd mention one little thing about the reciprocating relationship of this idea of honoring your father and your mother. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. What does it mean to honor thy father and the mother? Now, we see that phrase repeated both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Christ clearly says that we should obey the commandments, including that one. We hear that one over and over again, even in the epistles. The words that were used to be translated into this word honor in the Old Testament actually means to be heavy, to be weighty. So are we supposed to be heavy with our father and our mother? Actually, what they're talking about is to increase, to fatten your father and your mother. This honorarium that was given to father and mother, it's not about going to bed when they tell you, although you should do that too. It's about honoring your father and mother even after you depart from their house. When you get married and you separate and you should honor back to your father and your mother. Eventually, theoretically, whatever you give to your father, you will inherit. But that was a system of governance that was operating from the beginning, even before Israel, and it was just repeated again in Israel, and it was also repeated in the first century church. We still see remnants of that. But what's happened now is we've gone under the system of Corban, and Jesus says, you know, woe unto you, cried Corban, who make the law to no effect. What law is he talking about? Honor the father and the mother, because Corban was simply you give a stipends to the temple instead of honoring your father and your mother. And if they needed help, if they need fall on Social Security kind of need for benefits, they simply get them from the temple, which was a part of the government, just like we see today with Social Security. That's a system of Corban. And this honor thy father and thy mother was that money that went to them. You have to remember, income tax, a lot of people say income tax is not statutory. And of course, it isn't statutory. Income tax is a patrimonial right. It's the right of the father. The emperors imposed income tax. Herod began to impose an income tax. Jesus never did because he was returning to the ways of the kingdom. But it doesn't. There is a kind of income tax in the kingdom of heaven, but it's this honor thy father and thy mother. It isn't anybody kicking your door down. You have to make that choice. Remember, that choice is what makes a man a man. The exercise of charitable choice. That's the perfect law of liberty. It's maturing. The kingdom of heaven is only for virtuous people. It's for people who want to share, and people who are charitable, and people who are loving, people who are industrious, people who are not slothful. The kingdom of heaven doesn't work for people who are slothful. So in the New Testament, we also see this, the timios is one of the forms of the word to honor thy father and thy mother. And again, it's actually translated value as well as honor, but it means to estimate, to fix a value. So when they're saying fix a value on your father and your mother, no, they're talking about you decide what you're going to give your father and your mother according to the charity that is written upon your heart by your love of God. So this was the honorarium that was given to father and mother in the kingdom of heaven, and that's where all the taxes went. And then, of course, the tithes that went to the minister to support the minister actually came from the elder father, and he had the money to do that because it had come up to him by way of his sons and in his own earnings. And that was shared with the elder rabbi who had his sons ministering to all these families. And that's the way it worked. And it doesn't, you know, there's some flexibility in that. But that's a precept of how the system works. So that question, are men the property of the state or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today. A question brought up by Cecil B. DeMille in the Ten Commandments. Is that answerable by us today? Are we free souls under God or are we free souls under the gods that we have created for ourselves, that we have called on for ourselves, that we have created by contract, by contracting into body politics to obtain benefits? Remember, Peter says, through covetousness, they will make merchandise of you. You've desired their benefits. Like Proverbs says, you know, if you be a man of appetite, put a knife to your throat. If you sit and eat with a ruler, put a knife to your throat, for they serve you deceitful meats. And David says, your table is a snare for you. This concept is repeated over and over again. By desiring those benefits, and sometimes being cunningly coerced into waiving your rights due to ignorance, as the Supreme Court says, we have contracted into these systems and given up rights that God has given us and created obligations which brought us back into the bondage of Egypt. We need to repent and start turning around. This is a process. We need not to waste time in doing that, but we don't need to run out and get ourselves into trouble. We don't want anybody breaking the law. You need to understand what you're doing. You need to come together in congregations. You need to study these things out. Remember, I love this definition of redemption. Redemption is the deliverance from the power of an alien dominion and the enjoyment of the resulting freedom. It involves the idea of restoration to one who possesses a more fundamental right or interest. The best example of redemption in the Old Testament was the deliverance of the children of Israel from the bondage, from the dominion of the alien power in Egypt. Well, the best example of redemption in the New Testament, of course, is Jesus Christ. when his apostles came out and preached, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And with that, we found that they too were free, often persecuted, but free. And so now is the time of our redemption. Christ has arranged it for us. We need to only seek it out. Seek the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, and all else shall be granted unto you. Until we meet again, peace on your house, and may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.